Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Trevor Burris. I am a research fellow here at the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies, and I'd like to welcome you today to our excellent panel, what I'm sure will be an excellent panel, on the upcoming case of Janus versus Ask Me, as the pronunciation, I guess, of that acronym. This is a called Friedrichs Redux. A few years ago, when Justice Scalia died after a case called Friedrichs had been argued, and that case ended in a 4-4 tie. This case asked the same question about whether or not a 1977 case called Abood should be overruled and public sector unions should be prohibited from taking agency fees or fair share fees from non-members. So today we're going to discuss the case. We're going to have Ray LaJeunesse from National Right to Work Foundation. We have former Solicitor General Don Verrilli and my colleague Ilya Shapiro. Ray, I will introduce first. You can go first to give us a background of the case. Ray LaJeunesse Jr. is the Vice President and Legal Director of the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, a nonprofit legal aid organization. He was the first staff attorney on the foundation, employed, and has more than 40 years' experience of helping workers in litigation in federal and state courts and administrative agencies over the abuses of compulsory unionism. He became the foundation vice president and legal director in 2001. He has argued four cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, authored several published articles about labor law issues, testified before Congress on many occasions. He holds a BA in humanities from Providence College and an LLB from Washington Lee University School of Law. Ray?
Oh, be very blunt as to what is at stake in Janus. The question is whether the First Amendment permits government to add insult to injury by requiring public employees who have been deprived of the right to make their own employment contracts to also subsidize their state-imposed monopoly bargaining representative. And as Trevor mentioned, the problem began with the Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, which was decided by the Supreme Court in 1977. That was a foundation-supported case. I actually worked on that case, but I didn't get to argue it. I was too young at the time. At least that management thought I was. The court, that we did win part of that case. The court unanimously held that a union cannot constitutionally compel non-member public employees to subsidize its, quote, expression of political views on behalf of political candidates or toward the advancement of other ideological causes not germane to its duties as collective bargaining representative, end quote. However, 6-3, relying on private sector cases, the majority held that public employees can be compelled to subsidize a union's collective bargaining and contract administration with their government employer. That holding was really only a 5-4 holding because Justice Rehnquist concurred only because he had dissented in Elrod v. Burns, which held that political patronage, in other words, requiring somebody to support a political party, violates the First Amendment. He said, quote, had I joined the plurality opinion in Elrod, I would find it virtually impossible to join the court's opinion in this case. Justice Powell, joined by two other justices, identified two flaws in the majority decision. One, he said there's no basis for distinguishing collective bargaining activities from political activities as far as the First Amendment is concerned in the public sector because, quote, the public sector union is indistinguishable from the traditional political party, end quote. In other words, decisions reached through collective bargaining, as Justice Powell said, have a direct impact on the level of public services, priorities within state and municipal budgets, creation of bonded indebtedness and tax rates, end quote. And he said that by relying on private sector cases, the majority failed to require the proponents of forced fees for bargaining purposes to demonstrate that the purported state interests met exacting First Amendment scrutiny. Following Abood, National Right to Work Foundation attorneys representing public employees opposed to paying union fees litigated numerous expensive, complex, and protracted cases over drawing the line between chargeable and non-chargeable activities under Abood and or what procedures are required to protect employees' right not to subsidize union political and other non-bargaining activities. I mentioned the procedural cases because they ultimately led to getting the court to revisit the Abood holding. The first major case that got to the court, which brought the procedural issues to the court, was Chicago Teachers Union versus Hudson, which was decided in 1986. The court held that First Amendment due process requires that before compulsory union fees can be collected from public employees, they must be given adequate advance notice of the fee's basis, including an independent audit, an opportunity for a reasonably prompt, impartial review of employee challenges to the union's calculation of the fees, and an escrow of disputed fees while challenges are pending so that the union cannot use them for non-bargaining purposes. Well, in litigating how Hudson should be implemented, we got to the court again in Knox versus SEIU Local 1000, which was decided by the court in 2012. In that case, the union had sent out its annual Hudson notice, but it then imposed a special assessment on all unit employees, including non-members, to oppose two ballot propositions on the public ballot without giving non-members notice that they could opt out of paying for that special assessment. The court held 7-2 that an additional notice indeed was required, and 5-4, with an opinion written by Justice Alito, the court held that when a public sector union imposes a special assessment or dues increases, it not only must provide a notice, but, quote, it may not exact any funds from non-members without their affirmative consent, end quote. Well, significantly for the issues in Janus, that majority, in Justice Alito's opinion, held that, quote, compulsory subsidies for private speech are subject to exacting First Amendment scrutiny, which, of course, Abood had not done. And they have to serve a compelling state interest that cannot be achieved through means less restrictive of the free speech and association, the standard First Amendment exacting scrutiny. Moreover, that majority also said that, quote, free rider arguments, which Abood had relied on, are generally insufficient to overcome First Amendment objections, end quote. And that acceptance of such an argument in Abood was, Justice Alito said, something of an anomaly. Well, the next case was Harris v. Quinn. Illinois had imposed a mandatory union fee requirement on non-member home care personal assistants who aid disabled individuals, often their family members, and receive state Medicaid funds. But they're not public employees, they're just receiving state funds. But nonetheless, Illinois said you have to pay union dues. The Supreme Court, 5-4, held that this scheme violated the First Amendment because it did not serve a compelling state interest. In other words, they're applying the standard that Knox said applies. That could not be achieved through means significantly less restrictive of associational freedoms. The majority refused to extend Abood to these providers because it found Abood's analysis, quote, questionable on several grounds, end quote, all of which apply equally to public employees. And I'll list them. First, Abood, Justice Alito's opinion said, seriously erred in relying on private sector cases because the First Amendment analysis in those private sector cases was either thin or non-existent. In other words, it wasn't exacting scrutiny. Second, Abood failed to appreciate the judicially noticeable fact that in the public sector, but not in the private sector, quote, core issues such as wages, pension, and benefits are important political issues, end quote. In other words, basically what Justice Powell had said in Abood. Three, quote, Abood failed to appreciate the conceptual difficulty of distinguishing in public sector cases between union expenditures that are made for collective bargaining purposes and those that are made to achieve political ends, end quote. Because, obviously, because in bargaining, the union is trying to achieve political ends. Four, Abood did not anticipate, quote, the practical administrative problems that would result in attempting to classify public sector union expenditures as either chargeable or not. Problems that the court itself had encountered in cases since Abood, and which we, in litigating these cases, repeatedly encountered. Five, Abood did not foresee the heavy burden of expensive litigation that objecting non-members would face in challenging the union categorization of expenses. Individual employees could not bring those cases without the help of organizations like the Right to Work Foundation. Six, Abood's, quote, unsupported empirical assumption that the principle of exclusive representation in the public sector is dependent on a union or agency shop is unwarranted, unquote. Why? Because exclusive bargaining agents operate without force fees in the federal agencies and the U.S. Postal Service, the court noted, and I would add in the many right-to-work states. Harris did not overrule Abood only because the personal assistants in Harris were not full-fledged public employees, and so the issue wasn't directly presented. But it was, as Trevor noted, in the Friedrichs case, which was not decided, rather than decided by the court in 2016. The Friedrichs plaintiffs were California public school teachers, so it presented directly the question of whether Abood should be overruled. And the court granted cert to resolve that question. Oral argument was held on January 11, 2016. Observers, both in the legal press and the popular press, expected that the court would 5-4 overrule Abood. Unfortunately, Justice Scalia untimely passed before the decision could issue, and an equally divided court affirmed the Ninth Circuit's decision following Abood and also denied a motion for reconsideration because the court only had 8 members. Then comes Justice Gorsuch. So the court on September 28, 2017, granted a cert in our Janus versus AFSCME Council 31 case. Presents exactly the same question as in Friedrichs, and will be heard on February 26th by 9 justices. One of the questions, of course, is stare decisis. Ilya's going to address that at greater length than I will, but I will note that the court has not hesitated, I'm quoting from Citizens United, to overrule decisions offensive to the First Amendment. And Abood is offensive to the First Amendment because it permits the government to compel its employees to subsidize an advocacy group's political activity, that is, to subsidize speaking to the government to influence public policies. Abood should be overruled for the reasons stated in Harris, two of which, as I mentioned, had been recognized as early as Justice Powell's opinion in Abood. That is, the failure to recognize that bargaining with the government is core political speech, indistinguishable from lobbying. And secondly, Abood failed to follow the court's precedents that subject instances of compelled speech and association to heightened First Amendment scrutiny. And that only includes the Elrod line of cases, but a case called United Foods. Public sector force fees cannot survive that exacting First Amendment scrutiny. It's not the least restrictive means to achieve any compelling government interest. Even assuming that monopoly bargaining is such an interest, it can and is accomplished without force fees, as Justice Alito noted, in federal agencies, the post office, and I add the many right-to-work states that do not prohibit public sector bargaining. That is, why does it go on where you have right to work? Because exclusive representation is a very valuable power that unions covet and voluntarily assume. When you become a monopoly bargaining representative, you're the only interest group at the bargaining table. That's a tremendous power. And in the briefs that were filed in the Supreme Court in Janus, the respondents, the state of Illinois, represented by Attorney General Madigan, and the union, they don't attempt to show that the fees are a least restrictive means for public sector collective bargaining. Instead, they argue that force fees are subject to lesser scrutiny because the fees, they say, subsidize employee speech as part of the official duties required by the government as an employer. That's a justification not used by the Abood Court, which cuts against stare decisis. And a union is the state's adversary at the bargaining table. We can see that if you read the newspapers about what's going on in Illinois. So its speech is not government speech expressed through employees. It is advocacy by an independent interest group. Consequently, the government's forcing its employees to subsidize that advocacy is not managerial in nature. It is coercion, infringing on the employee's First Amendment right as citizens to choose which political speech, if any, they want to support. That infringement warrants strict exacting scrutiny, which it fails for the reasons Harris gave. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. Next, we'll be hearing from Donald B. Verrilli, Jr. He's a partner with Munger, Tolis, and Olson, and the founder of its Washington, D.C. office. He's one of the nation's premier Supreme Court and appellate advocates. He served as Solicitor General from June 2011 to June 2016. During that time, he argued dozens of cases before the Supreme Court. Sometimes Cato was on your side, and sometimes we were not, and was responsible for representing the government in all appellate matters before the High Court. He was, before serving as SG, he served as Deputy White House Counsel and previously as Associate Deputy Attorney General for the DOJ. Before joining the government, he spent two decades in private practice representing companies in their most high-stakes matters, particularly in the areas of media, entertainment, telecommunications, and First Amendment. He's a graduate of Yale and Columbia Law School.
Thanks very much for that gracious introduction. It's terrific to be here, and I definitely preferred it when Cato was on my side as Solicitor General. But whether Cato was on my side or not, the Cato Institute's advocacy before the Supreme Court was always at a superb level of quality and always contributed in a very meaningful way to the court's consideration of cases before it. So I'm here, I guess, to give you the other side of the story on this case. Among the cases I argued as Solicitor General were Harris against Quinn and Friedrichs, two of the cases we've been talking about today. And in both of those cases, the United States did file an amicus brief on the side of the state employer. The United States has taken a different view in the brief that it filed in the Janus case. In order to kind of give you the alternative way of thinking about this, we could start with stare decisis. We've talked about it a little bit. I guess we're going to talk about it some more. The decision has been on the books for 40-some-odd years. It is the kind of decision that creates a legal framework that parties then bargain in accordance with and set their terms in accordance with, and develop practices over time, and employment relation practices over time. So I do think that there's quite a strong stare decisis interest here, but I actually don't want to focus on that. What I want to focus on is, fine, let's talk about first principles here. In terms of thinking about the nature of the First Amendment claim being made and the context in which it's being made, what First Amendment rules should apply? Well, one, I think, interesting point to start with is originalism. You know, if you're an originalist and you believe that the Constitution's provisions ought to be given the meaning that they had, the original public meaning at the time of enactment, you don't really have an argument, I don't think, that there's a First Amendment problem here with public sector agency fee requirements. And the reason I say that traces to a dissenting opinion by Justice Scalia in the Rutan case, which was a case about the constitutionality of patronage practices in state employment hiring, whether you could hire people based on their political affiliation. Majority of the courts said that those kinds of employment practices by states were subject to serious First Amendment scrutiny, and you needed a significant justification in order to engage in that practice. Justice Scalia dissented, pointing out that at the time of the framing and for a very long time thereafter, well, more than a century thereafter, there was never any doubt that it was constitutional for state and local government employers to hire people on the basis of their political affiliation for any job they wanted, and that was the original understanding of the First Amendment. And it seems to me if that was the original understanding of the First Amendment and you are an originalist, then a fortiori, what happens with public sector agency fees is constitutional. But even moving beyond that, I think the thing, this is, you know, if you put this in one framework, the issue in this case, I understand the appeal of the argument that there's a First Amendment problem here with respect to the rights of individual employees. But I think the problem with that line of argument is that there's another framework into which one can, and I submit one should, consider this case, and that's the question of what kinds of constitutional rights do public employees have as public employees, and what kinds of prerogatives does government have as employer, as opposed to as sovereign regulating the citizenry. If you looked at the regulation at issue here as though it were a regulation of the by the sovereign of the citizens in their role as citizens, well, of course you'd think there was a problem with it. But you know, what we actually have under the First Amendment is a very long tradition of recognizing that when the government acts as an employer, that it has significantly more latitude to restrict the First Amendment interests of its employees in a manner that it couldn't do with the citizenry at large. And the government, and that's been expressed in cases going back many decades, long before Abood, in all kinds of areas. The Hatch Act cases, for example, the Constitution, the Supreme Court's upholding the constitutionality of the Hatch Act's restrictions on the political activities of federal employees, one example. But then most prominently, you know, there are a whole host of cases that the Supreme Court has decided over time in which public employees raised First Amendment free speech or First Amendment petition clause challenges to discipline that had been imposed on them by their employer for engaging in speech activity that the employer considered to be inconsistent with the employment mission of the government agency. And in each of those cases, going back many years, the court rejected the argument that parallels the argument that's being made challenging agency fees, namely that this is an area in which exacting First Amendment scrutiny should apply because of the First Amendment interest of the employee. Instead, what the court has said in all of these cases, including very recently, what the court has said in all of these cases is that you first ask yourself in a case like this, is the speech at issue, is the employee speaking as a citizen on a matter of public concern? That's the threshold test. And if the answer to that is no, then there's no First Amendment inquiry at all. It's the government action is just constitutional. But if the answer to that question is yes, then in this line of authority, you don't move to exacting scrutiny, you move to a balancing test. That even where the employee is speaking as a citizen on a matter of public concern, that if the government has a reasonable ground for imposing the speech restriction that is related to the government's carrying out of its mission, providing, delivering services to the people or whatever the government mission is, then that's constitutional. That was the holding in the Garcetti case, Burrow of Duryea case, you name it. I mean, there's a, you know, this is a very long line of authority. Now, you can disagree with that line of authority, but it seems to me one thing you can't do here is pretend that it doesn't exist, because it is that line of authority that the state of Illinois Friedrichs and state of California Friedrichs, state of Illinois in this case, and public employers generally invoke to justify agency fee requirements. They don't deny that there's some impingement on the expressive interests of the employee because they would prefer not to pay these fees to fund expressive activity with which they disagree. But they've made a judgment that the most effective way to manage their workforces is to embrace collective bargaining and to ensure that the collective bargaining agent is sufficiently empowered by being sufficiently funded and by and avoiding the kind of internecine strife among the workforce that can arise in situations in which you have collective bargaining but you don't have agency fees, and then there is this very powerful incentive to free ride. And that incentive to free ride is really at the core of the argument in favor of the government's authority to impose an agency fee requirement as part of its decision to opt for collective bargaining as its way of managing its public sector workforce. The argument going back a long time and again being very persuasively articulated by Justice Scalia in opinions of his, that the free rider problem here, A, undeniably exists. You know, whether you oppose the union's goals and activities or whether you support them, you are going to be the beneficiary of those activities if you are a member of the workforce because of the exclusive representation requirement and the obligation, the duty of fair representation, the obligation that the union advance the interests of all workers in the workforce equally. You're going to benefit. So you have an incentive, a natural human incentive, and you know the foundation of Manker Olson's famous work, The Logic of Collective Action. You've got an incentive to not pay the fee if you're going to get the benefit. And that's true whether you support the union or oppose it. And so there's a real significant free rider collective action problem here. And as Justice Scalia pointed out in his opinions, it's different from the kind of free rider problem that exists with respect to advocacy organizations in the private sector. Certainly there's a free rider problem there. You know, not everybody contributes to Cato Institute's advocacy activities, even though many people may agree with what the Cato Institute is trying to accomplish, because they know that you're going to advocate it whether they contribute or not. But the difference, Justice Scalia pointed out, is that that in the public sector context, it's the law that requires it's the law that requires the organization to engage in the activity on behalf of all workers, and that it's the law that creates the free rider problem. It's not just kind of a natural circumstance that might arise in the private sector. Now, you can agree with that point of view. You can disagree with that point of view. You know, different states have taken different approaches. The federal government's taken a different approach than states. Some cities take one approach. Some states take another. You know, some states, no collective bargaining at all. Some states, collective bargaining, no agency fees. Some states, collective bargaining, you know, with Wisconsin, collective bargaining with agency fees for police and fire, but nobody else. You know, different states and localities have made different judgments about what they think the best approach is. But they've done that in their role as employer, managing a public workforce, trying to decide how to deliver public services in the most effective manner possible. And given that the existence of that doctrinal framework that I described, I think the question, and the hard question for the people challenging the constitutionality of agency fees, is to explain, A, why that alternative framework that applies to every other example of government as employer regulating the speech interests of its employees shouldn't apply here, even though it applies to everything else, A. And B, if you apply exacting scrutiny here, how are you going to not undermine that entire structure that allows a government to manage its workforce effectively? For example, the next time a sheriff or other high-ranking official in a local government brings a grievance, based on sheriff's speech activity, which led to a discipline, and brings a grievance and has his grievance denied, and then brings a First Amendment claim, you know, is that at that point, why is the public interest, the public nature of that speech activity by the sheriff, any less powerful than the public nature of the speech activity that that the challengers to agency fees are pointing out here? How are you going to deny exacting scrutiny in that circumstance if you allow it in this circumstance? And so it seems to me one additional significant concern with the approach that the challengers to Abood bring, and one that I frankly don't think is meaningfully addressed, at least yet, is the risk of destabilizing that entire framework and creating robust First Amendment claims for government employees to challenge what are now routine disciplinary decisions and routine grievance proceedings that employers rely on in order to ensure an effective management of the workforce. So I do think when you sort of think about it from the perspective of the government's interests here, you really do have to grapple with the fact that what we're talking about is government as employer managing its workforce, and there's a distinct set of First Amendment rules that applies in that framework. And then on the other side of the coin, I think you've got to ask yourself, with respect to the First Amendment interests of the individual employees, even putting aside the fact that the free rider problem I think exists with respect to people who may even agree with what the union wants to do, but even putting that aside, what you're talking about here is the payment of an agency fee that is going to, if the system is working properly, support the collective bargaining activities and not the political activities of the union, acknowledging there have been, you know, there really have been fights about that, about drawing that line, the difficulty of drawing that line, and whether it's in the right place. And I think one could make an argument that it hasn't landed in the right place and it needs to move. But that's what you're talking about here. This doesn't seem to me to be a situation in which the payment of the agency fee sends a message to anyone in the world that the individual employee actually supports the union. What it sends is a message that I have a job in a collectively bargained situation in which there are agency fees that I, like everybody else, must pay. That's the message, it seems to me, that the existence of agency fees sends to the world. And so if an individual employee, by the payment of the fee, is sending any message, that's the only message. And then the question of whether the compulsory nature of this, it ought to create such a significant First Amendment interest that you have to have exacting scrutiny, I think you got to ask yourself about, I mean, just think of yourself as taxpayer. You pay in taxes money to your local government, your state government, your federal government that I am certain funds expressive activity that you don't agree with. And that really is just a fact of life. It happens all the time. It happens to every one of us as citizens. And is, you know, given everything else that I just described in terms of the government's interest as employer here, is this really a weighty enough First Amendment interest that you're going to take this step of overruling a precedent of 40-some-odd years' existence that has significant reliance interests bound up around it, that you're going to destabilize this framework that is very important to the government as employer generally in order to manage its affairs? You know, that's a it seems to me you need a really powerful justification to take that step, and I, for one, I don't think I've heard it. Thank you.
Thank you, Don. And last we'll be hearing from Ilya Shapiro, who's a senior fellow here at the Center for Constitutional Studies and editor-in-chief of the Cato Supreme Court Review. Before joining Cato, he was special assistant advisor to the multinational force in Iraq on rule of law issues and practiced at Patton Boggs and Cleary Gottlieb. He's the co-author of Religious Liberties for Corporations, Hobby Lobby, the Affordable Care Act, and the Constitution. He has contributed to a variety of academic, popular, and professional publications and is coordinator of the Cato Amicus Brief Program, which I work with him on, has filed more than 300 Friends of the Court briefs, including one that the Greenback selected for its exemplary legal writing collection, which I also wrote a good percentage of. He holds an AB from Princeton, an MSc from London School of Economics, and a JD from Chicago. Ilya?
Well, Trevor, thanks for that, and I'm glad that you finally got admitted to the bar so you can get some of the credit for the work that I've been more than happy to take credit for over the years. It's an honor. I mean, this is obviously I'm on this stage not infrequently, but it's an honor to share the stage with Ray, one of the nation's experts on labor law. You know, as a constitutional generalist, I don't claim expertise in any particular specific area, but it's great to have someone who knows that much about labor law, which is ever more important in our public life. And with Don, I mean, the club of former solicitors general is almost as small as the club of former presidents. I mean, this is an elite thing, and to have witnessed his advocacy, even when I didn't agree with it, you can appreciate the skill and the expertise. And so I'm delighted to oppose him, I guess, in this circumstance. I want to address, first of all, just briefly, I'm sure Ray will cover more of this in his response and Q&A, the free rider thing. One of the arguments specifically that Mark Janus is bringing here that Rebecca Friedrichs brought previously was that, I don't want the benefit of this bargain. I'm not so much a free rider as a forced rider. Maybe I'd like more merit pay rather than tenure protections or whatever the issue might be in the particular specific circumstance. And so That's great. I don't want a free ride. You can disqualify me from that particular benefit. I would accept that. So that, again, is one of the issues that's at play here. But I want to focus on a more technical jurisprudential issue. So bear with me, the non-lawyers who are watching, although I think this really gets to the heart of this case, because especially John Roberts and the Roberts Court care in terms of minimalism and not overstepping bounds and not deciding more than needs to be decided. This issue of stare decisis, how much to rely on precedent, or rather this prudential doctrine that says that sometimes there is a greater social cost or a cost to underlying legal infrastructure upon which we conduct our lives. There's a greater cost in getting an old right wrong in terms of social upheaval and whatnot, than in getting that and then in correcting that long-held error. So obviously, that's central when at issue is: do you overturn a 40-year-old precedent? And I don't know. Could be that John Roberts could engage in some other twistification and allow Mark Janus to win without overruling Abood. I don't see it myself. I think Foursquare. This doctrine of charging agency fees, you can't allow it if Abood is still good law. And I think that the reason why stare decisis as applied here, similar to how it was applied in Citizens United, where John Roberts, his entire concurrence focused on the stare decisis issue, here stare decisis actually is very weak. First of all, because constitutional rights are at issue, this is not an area where Congress can simply, like they did, say, with the Lilly Ledbetter Act and employment discrimination law, change the law if they don't like the result of the Supreme Court's interpretation. But moreover, the prudential policy factors and special justifications that the court considers when applying the doctrine weigh in favor of overturning Abood. And this is particularly true with regard to Abood's insupportable introduction of the labor peace rationale into the First Amendment context. Labor peace is simply not a sufficiently compelling government interest to justify compelled speech. It might be compelling for other reasons, recognizing a union as an exclusive bargainer or what have you, but not for compelling speech. And so let's look at the doctrine kind of in the abstract before we apply it to Janus. So first of all, stare decisis is a principle of policy that promotes prudential considerations like the even-handed, predictable, and consistent development of legal principles. The court kind of squarely held in a case called Payne versus Tennessee from 1991. That's always invoked whenever overruling precedent is a possibility. And the doctrine can be traced back to the earliest foundations of English, or dare I say, Anglo-American common law. For all its rich history and noble purposes, stare decisis is neither an inexorable command to be blindly followed, as the court said in Lawrence versus Texas, where, of course, it overturned its own precedent, nor a mechanical formula of adherence to the latest decisions. In contrast to common law or statutory cases, which legislatures can fix if they don't like the result, with constitutional violations, stare decisis is at a lower ebb. And so it's long been observed that the doctrine has only a limited application in the field of constitutional law. And in our brief, we have just a slew of citations to justices across history making that point. And in particular, the court has not hesitated to overrule what it considers to be erroneous decisions with regard to the First Amendment. Just in the last 50 years, the court has overturned no fewer than 7 precedents in the free speech context. Brandenburg versus Ohio, West Virginia versus Barnett, Virginia State Pharmacy Board. I mean, all sorts of contexts, rights of students in school, commercial speech, Miller versus California, an NLRB case, Hudgens. Citizens United itself, of course, overruled a 20-year-old precedent, Austin versus Michigan Chamber of Commerce, and in part, McConnell versus FEC as well. Citizens United, by the way, the reason why it could so easily overturn that precedent was because Austin was the only example of the court accepting a restriction on political speech for a reason other than corruption or the appearance of corruption. So it really was an anomaly. And as I'll get to in a moment, Abood itself is also an anomaly in terms of a justification for compelling speech. So I think judges do have a duty to correct legal misinterpretations, especially in constitutional cases. As Lord Cook said, it's the function of a judge not to make but to declare the law. And so they don't just slavishly follow whatever their predecessors did. Their ultimate fidelity, of course, is to the constitutional text, unless, of course, the reliance interests are, as I've said before, are so pronounced that it would just cause chaos in the streets. And as Justice Thomas, I think, has convincingly argued over the years, that interpretation or understanding of reliance interests, I think, can be overly weighted, especially by lawyers who are by character often very cautious. As Justice Stanley Reed explained before taking a seat on the court, a judge applying a constitutional provision must always measure the decisions of his predecessors against the document which they're interpreting. However high the authority of the prior decisions, they remain inferior to the law itself. Or, as Chief Justice Roberts wrote in Citizens United, when fidelity to any particular precedent does more damage this constitutional ideal than to advance it, this court must be more willing to depart from that precedent. And so courts weigh all sorts of competing considerations, generally prudential and pragmatic ones. This is not about being an originalist or a textualist, because, again, this is not a question of whether the old precedent is wrong. I mean, if the old precedent was right, then there's no need to consider stare decisis because you're not overturning anything. But if it was wrong, then you have these pragmatic considerations of just how much would it upset the established law. For example, I think that Social Security is facially unconstitutional. Those decisions by the Supreme Court in the late 30s, the constitutional revolution of 1937, go against a document that does not empower Congress to make redistributional monetary transfers, whether for widows and orphans, as the original Social Security program allowed, or now for all retirees. And yet, if the court were to so hold tomorrow, there would be chaos in the streets. So I would advise, if ever we got to a point, you know, I have lower hanging fruit, including Wickard versus Filburn, you know, getting the Commerce Clause under control and all these sorts of things. But if the court ever were to get to that consideration where it were reconsidering Helbring versus Davis and other things, then I would advise the court to stay its mandate for a year or two and allow the people to catch up by passing a constitutional amendment. If Social Security, if they would not pass a constitutional amendment to allow Social Security at that point, well, I guess the reliance interests weren't that strong in the first place, but I imagine that they would. So in addition, again, to evaluating the legal and factual developments, a court must consider the practical consequences. And I think that the mere fact that Abood was badly reasoned and produces erroneous results may or not be sufficient to justify overturning it as precedent, but the special justifications for abandoning precedent, which should matter less in constitutional cases, do factor heavily in overturning Abood. So let's turn to the specifics here. This labor peace rationale, the idea that if the federal government isn't able to, or the government, the state or federal, isn't able to get its way here, then there would be violence or clashes or problems with commerce or what have you. The problem here is precisely that the labor peace rationale, as it arose starting about 100 years ago and then through the New Deal, was applied by the court as a Commerce Clause jurisprudential hook, that is, the reason why Congress can get involved in regulating labor and employer relations in certain ways is to prevent interference with interstate commerce. And so that allowed the federal power, the use of federal power there. These were not First Amendment cases or implications of other kinds of rights. Indeed, although First Amendment claims were made in later cases in the 50s and 60s, the Hansen case in 1956, Machinist versus Street in 1961, the key cases on which Abood rests. But again, both of these cases used labor peace as justification for Congress's jurisdiction. And to the extent that Hansen involved First Amendment claims. They talked about the workers not wanting to pay for, quote, propaganda for economic or political programs, which may be abhorrent to them. And so Hansen and Street can be justification for perhaps allowing charging of fees or disallowing charging of fees for political activity, but they didn't answer the question of whether you can compel fees for collective bargaining or other non-political purposes. As I imagine Ray might get into as well in response to Q&A, again, this goes to the merits, not to the stare decisis, to the wrongness of the decision. The principal claim here is that whatever a union does in the public sector context is necessarily political because it has an impact on education structures and budgets, on government contracts for building highways, whatever the issue is, healthcare provision, those obviously have public policy salience. And so even if money weren't fungible, it would be hard to make that artificial distinction. And again, Abood, just Foursquare, relied on these old cases from the 50s and 60s, Street and Hansen, and talked about using collected funds for political purposes. So you have labor peace to justify federal regulation, but then later opinions clarifying that even in the interest of labor peace, you can't charge fees for political purposes. So now, seeing that kind of odd mismatch of justifying agency fees on this basis, the union and the states here attempt to conflate the Abood precedent with other lines of precedent, notably a case called Pickering. I won't get into that, but the problem here is if you're kind of doing a switch of justifications, then what kind of reliance is there really on this? Then Solicitor General Kagan ran into this problem in arguing Citizens United because she was attempting to switch the justification for restrictions of corporate political speech from a leveling the playing field or equalization of voices kind of one that Austin was based on to something different. And that certainly contributed to what Chief Justice Roberts described in his concurrence about why there was a weak reliance on quote, poorly reasoned precedent. That is, he said, quote, underlying reasoning has become so discredited that the court cannot keep the precedent alive without jury-rigging new and different justifications to shore up the original mistake. I consider Abood to be just as much an anomaly of First Amendment jurisprudence as Austin was in the Citizens United context. Nobody really relies on having less First Amendment rights, and Abood's confusion of powers and rights marked a significant departure from the court's prior jurisprudence. Among other things, when we're talking about economic regulation, the court is very deferential, unfortunately, in my view, but it is, whereas if you're judging First Amendment interests, that should be subject to a higher scrutiny. So there's another mismatch there. And so I think Abood now is no more than a remnant of an abandoned doctrine. As the court said in the 1988 case of Riley versus National Federation of the Blind, the First Amendment mandates that we presume speakers, not the government, know best both what they want to say and how to say it. Government may not substitute its judgment as to how to speak best for that of speakers and listeners. And so there's the court has explicitly declared, not just in the Harris and Knox cases, that the First Amendment doesn't allow the government to require subsidization of political speech absent some narrowly tailored interest. Now, as far as I can tell, there's really no valid reliance interest here at all, other than, of course, the unions enjoying that they have all this money that's filling their coffers. That's kind of a practical interest, and that's why they're fighting this all the way to the Supreme Court. As the 28 states that don't have these kinds of agency shop laws show, it's not that the unions there have disappeared. They just fight in other ways. And yes, their coffers are smaller, per capita than they are in the states with public sector unions that do have agency fees. But again, that's just because in those states, workers who don't want to be forced to subsidize what I consider to be this kind of political activity, whether through collective bargaining or otherwise, that's where they're getting the other money from. Otherwise, the labor contracts are not changed at all. That is, the whatever mechanisms are in place for adjudicating grievances or anything else can still be in place. Finally, Abood has consistently been a subject of dispute among the justices, not just in Knox and Harris. For example, the 1991 case of Leonard versus Ferris Faculty Association. Justice Scalia threw some shade on Abood, as did Justice Thurgood Marshall, I should say. He identified one ridiculous potential outcome of the hypothetical application of what the plurality decided there. Anyway, I think I'm going over time, so I just wanted to say that it's not just about the five justices in the majority in Knox and Harris that have disputed this problem. Abood has spawned extensive and pernicious infringements of worker rights of millions of people for the last 40 years. Countless millions of dollars have been improperly appropriated from the pockets of these individuals and funneled into the coffers of organizations they wish not to associate with, or to further causes that they don't want to support. And so stare decisis, properly applied, not only allows for the abandonment of a precedent that's so thoroughly repugnant to our Constitution, but indeed demands it. The country's public sector workers deserve at long last to have their First Amendment liberties restored. Thanks.
I think Ray knows something about the Leonard case. Didn't you argue that?
That was my case.
Yeah. So before we open up for questions, I'd like to give everyone a chance to respond to things being said. So Ray?
Sure. One of the arguments that the my opponent here, the former solicitor, made was from originalism, citing the Justice Scalia's dissent in one of the patronage cases. Well, that's kind of a strange argument. Number one, he was in the minority. And number two, that same Justice Scalia joined the majority in both Knox and Harris and appeared to be ready to do so at the oral argument in Friedrichs. There's a big difference between patronage, which existed at the founding, and forced unionism in the public sector, which didn't come into existence until late 50s or early 1960s. In addition, the framers were very much opposed to compelling one citizen to support the speech of another citizen, or one group to support the speech of another group. They were opposed to what they called factions. And I just quote from Justice Powell in Street, Justice Black, going all the way back to Street, where he said, the views of Madison and Jefferson authentically represent the philosophy embodied in the safeguards of the First Amendment, which leaves the federal government no power whatever to compel one man to expend his energy, his time, or his money to urge ideologies and causes he believes would be hurtful to the country. So I think that takes care of the originalism argument. The balancing test, Mr. Varelli says applies, originated in the Pickering case, which was decided before Abood. Abood did not rely on it. And in Harris, that line of cases was argued by the union and the state, and it was rejected by the majority in Harris. What you're talking about with an individual in public employee's speech, it doesn't affect the public fisc. But when you're talking about a collective bargaining agreement or new benefits for all of the public employees, that does affect the public fisc. And therefore, it's a matter of great public concern, as the court held in Harris. And there they were talking not just about providers receiving Medicaid money. Their context was in public employment. Mr. Varelli also tried to make an analogy between compulsory union fees and taxes, But the union isn't government, as Justice Powell recognized in Abood. It's one thing for the government to take money to spend itself. It's another thing for the government to take money from one group of citizens and give it to another interest group. And with regard to the free rider argument, not only was it criticized in Knox, but it was in fact argued by the losers in Harris and rejected by the court, the majority of the court. And they said, a host of organizations advocate on behalf of the interests of persons falling within an occupational group, and many of these groups are quite successful even though they are dependent on voluntary contributions. Respondents showing, in other words, the free rider argument, falls far short of what the First Amendment demands.
Don?
Okay, couple of points. Back to originalism, just because I find this interesting. I'm going to read you something from an opinion written by Justice Kennedy in the Garcetti case, which was decided, I think, about 2006, which was one of these cases about First Amendment public employment. Until the mid-20th century, the unchallenged dogma was that a public employee had no right to object to conditions of employment, including those which restricted the exercise of constitutional rights. Then he referenced Oliver Wendell Holmes' famous opinion in 1892 when he was on the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. A policeman may have a constitutional right to talk politics, but he has no constitutional right to be a policeman. So, you know, you don't have to be an originalist. Most of the justices aren't. Most people who think about the First Amendment aren't. But let's get real. You cannot in good faith say you're an originalist and make the First Amendment challenge that's being made to agency fees. Period. I mean, I'm just reading you what the Supreme Court itself has said. Second point, I think it's important to think about in terms of this idea. Well, some states do it one way, some states do it another. Yes, they do. That's called federalism. So another thing you're throwing out the window here with this is the idea that federalism has a role to play, that there ought to be discretion for state and local governments who are closer to the people to make judgments about how best to manage their workforces. So that, I think you got to take cognizance of that. Third, with respect to this idea that Abood didn't rely on this Pickering case, you know, we can argue back and forth about the extent to which the court actually relied on the specific case of Pickering when it decided Abood. But the main point is this, and it's got two components to it. The first one is, well before Pickering, in fact, stretching back into the earlier decades of the 20th century, the court was engaged in this balancing process, saying when the government's acting as employer, it gets a lot more latitude. The government's interests, regulatory interests are stronger, the speech interests of the employer are weaker. There's the Mitchell case, which I mentioned about the Hatch Act, and there's several other cases preceding Pickering, employed that balancing framework. You look at Abood, that's all it was doing. And if anything, what has happened in the decades since Abood is that balancing framework and the importance of the government's interest as employer in managing its workforce has been given more and more deference by the Supreme Court. So far from eroding the constitutional foundation of Abood, it has been strengthened by the development of the First Amendment jurisprudence in these 40-plus years. And then, you know, finally, with respect to the, I guess sort of repeating the federalism point here a little bit, I guess, but with respect to the policy point, I'm sorry, one more point about Leonard. You know, you can read Justice Scalia's opinion in Leonard as throwing a little shade on Abood, I suppose, but I'd actually ask all of you to go back and read that opinion, because that's the opinion in which he explains that the free rider justification is a sufficiently powerful justification to justify any impingement on First Amendment rights, so long as the scope of what agency fees support are appropriately cabined. That's where Justice Scalia said that. And then finally, with respect to the policy issue, you know, you can look at this as the unions getting all this money into their coffers if you want. But I do think it's important to take seriously the point that there are state and local governments that have made a decision that this is the best way to manage their workforce. Now, they may be in states and localities where there's a significant unionized presence in the private sector, and they've got to compete for workers with that unionized presence in the private sector. And there may be other reasons for it, too. But they've made that judgment in the exercise of their authority as employers. And it would be quite a striking thing to accord that no deference here when it gets so much deference generally when you're talking about the First Amendment interests of public employees.
I'll just say on the federalism point, you know, I take second place to no man in defending federalism, whether we're talking about occupational licensing or sexual privacy or the First Amendment. However, there's a baseline, a floor below which states simply cannot invade. And so to argue that this is a question of federalism is really begging the question of what that baseline is, which is what the heart of the First Amendment dispute is.
Before I open up to questions, I would take moderator privilege to actually ask Don, in Abood, in the distinction between actual political advocacy, do you agree that that was correctly decided, that you can't force people to fund actual political advocacy?
Sure.
And would you accept that there would be as applied challenges to how unions spend the money that would not forward the aims that you put forward? So at the convention for Ask Me, they had advocacy for gun control and things like this, and that was all paid by charged dues up to about $300,000.
So, you know, I, you know, like Ilya, maybe like you, I'm not a labor law expert. I haven't spent a huge amount of time diving into that. But I don't think there's any doubt. And when I tried to get ready for the oral arguments in Harris and Friedrich, I remember taking a look at these kinds of issues. There are all kinds of line drawing issues. I'm sure there are lots of arguments that can be made that the lines are being drawn in the wrong place. But I think those are questions that ought to be taken quite seriously. That, to me, is a different matter from saying that there is no core in which a state or a local government can choose as a matter of managing its workforce to operate in this way.
All right, open it up for questions. First one here to Jim Young from National Right to Work. I added you. Anonymous speech is okay here, by the way.
You can
identify who you want,
Trevor.
You don't.
We've known each other long enough that I expected you to identify me, and I'd also add that I argued the Knox case for the plaintiffs in Knox, petitioners, excuse me. I guess this is directed, first of all, a comment. I don't know how much I'd hang my hat on Justice Scalia's opinion in Leonard, since he also said essentially that it was the Right to Work Lawyers Full Employment Act, and I certainly approve of that. But I would also point out that a couple of things. First of all, isn't the notion of underlying the free rider rationale that every person in the bargaining unit actually enjoys a benefit really a union vanity that's been untested in any of these courts? I can't think of a case where actual benefit was required to be proved by the court. And second, it seems to me that some time ago, people who are AFSCME's amici in this case were complaining about distortion of the political process. And it strikes me that there's nothing more distorting for the political process than using somebody else's money for your politics. People who complain about big money in politics, at least that's people's own money. This is a situation where it's, say, taking somebody else's money and using them in politics. And finally, I think I'd ask, isn't the real problem here that if we find a benefit in union monopoly or collective bargaining, if the government finds benefit in that, isn't the fact that people are being forced to pay it, aside from being a rather damning indictment of that system, isn't it really a question of political leaders who lack the courage to use public funds to subsidize that activity because they know they can't get forcing the voters and the taxpayers to subsidize that activity past those voters?
Comments?
Is that a question? There
are 3 points in there, I think. Yeah. About does there have to be an actual benefit for free riding?
So, to address the second of your 3 points, you know, it's possible to think maybe that Citizens United was wrong, I guess that argument about hypocrisy, I get it, but I think it runs in both directions here, doesn't it? In that, no doubt that I assume that you thought Citizens United was correct, and that kind of a rationale didn't justify government action. And so, but, you know, in terms of the last point you made, you know, I do think to try to get it, you know, to a more practical level and just talk about what the government's interest is here, rather than, you know, I could engage that at an ideological level, but I think just at a more practical level, seems to me a government could make a judgment. It wouldn't have to, you know, it's my point about federalism, but the government could make a judgment that, you know, really, if the government is paying directly, subsidizing directly in that way, that the workers in the union weren't going to have nearly as much confidence in the union actually being on their side and representing their interests as opposed to being just an appendage of management, and therefore they could think it's much more sensible to structure things in the way that they're structured with agency fees. And of course, in the private sector, again, I'm no labor law expert, but I think it would be illegal for the private employer to do that. And I think the reason for that is in part because of the concern of corrupting the union. So if a public employer made a judgment that, you know, we want this system to work, we don't think it'll work that way, you can, you know, maybe it's about political will and courage, but it also seems to me it's much more likely to be, and certainly quite reasonably could be, about making a judgment about what's going to make the system work effectively.
I think we'll get to everyone.
Jim Duhom, unaffiliated. As I understand the history of Abood from Mr. Lajeunesse, it's been restricted and questioned over the years. So my first question is whether there would be any justifiable reliance given the notice to unions and their members that what may happen could well be coming. But beyond that, I question whether this is really a question of overruling a precedent. It sounds like it was a 5-4 decision to start from. It's been questioned in 1912 or in 2012. The court appeared ready to overrule it. In 2016, it almost certainly would have overruled it. So it strikes me that the status of Abood now might have been would be much like the status of Plessy against Ferguson in 1954. I mean, is there really anything left to overrule?
Well, all of those factors that you mention, I think, militate, support the argument that I was making, I think, that it's never been as accepted as some other precedents. Now, I wouldn't put it as much into the anti-canon as Plessy versus Ferguson, but I don't think it... when decided, I don't think it lent to kind of a stable development of labor relations, and certainly now it's been outmoded.
I would just add that it's necessary that Abood be overruled, because until it is, state and local governments are going to continue to force non-members to pay those union fees.
It's not as good a part. There.
Thank you. I'm Peter Murphy. I'm not a lawyer, but I've heard several times this idea of government's interest, and I don't mean to be cute by saying this, but it seems the government's made up of elected officials, and their interest in many parts of the country is to have the system as it stands now, where, because it's basically, well, maybe money laundering. I mean, you have these forced dues that find their way into their campaign coffers, and it's just a nice little system to exist by. I mean, I don't mean to be glib about it, but I just wondered if you could address that issue of what exactly is the government's interest in keeping it the way it is, other than this political reality that they're thriving on in many parts of the country.
I guess that's for me, right? Yeah. I guess what I would suggest is that the starting premise ought to be a little different, that the starting premise ought to be that state and local governments have made the judgment they've made for good reasons and for the reasons that they say they're making these judgments for, which is that they think that collective bargaining is a more effective way to manage the workforce. I mean, you know, state and local governments are in the business of delivering government services to the people, fire, sanitation, education, right? That's the especially, you know, local governments, that's their function principally, to deliver those services. You deliver those services through your workforce. So you have to figure out how to manage your workforce most effectively. Now, they don't have to choose collective bargaining, but sometimes they do. And they do through a majoritarian process, which therefore has the legitimacy of a majoritarian process behind it. They make those judgments, and then they try to implement them in a manner that allows them to deliver services more effectively. That, you know, we can debate the genesis of this idea about labor peace being a, whether it's a compelling interest or not, but, you know, if there's a strike, if there's a transit strike, it disables a city. Governments don't want that to happen. But even beyond that, governments want, just like a private employer, they want a workforce that is working with them and not against them. They want a workforce that's helping them to innovate, that's willing to take chances with employment security in order to do so. They need all of those things in order to maximize their ability to deliver services effectively. And some state and local governments make the choice to use collective bargaining and then to make sure collective bargaining works by requiring agency fees in order to try to deliver services to the people in that way. That seems to me to be a totally legitimate and sufficient explanation for why governments choose the system, which is, I think, a little different from the one that you're suggesting.
I'm actually not sure that the government has an interest one way or the other, apart from what the particular elected officials might, how they view the policy considerations. This is one of the cases in which the new administration switched positions, not coincidentally, the way the states line up also is, based very much, I don't know if it's a complete partisan lineup, but it's certainly policy-wise. If you think agency fees are a good idea, you're on one side. If you think they're a bad idea, they're on the other side. So it's far from clear for me that there's actually a legal rationale on one side or the other for a government interest.
Or the government's interest possibly in not being extorted into giving pension promises that will bankrupt the state. That could be a good one, too. Roger Pilon?
Yes, Roger Pilon, Cato Institute. You opened your remarks, Mr. Varelli, by saying that you were going to return to first principles, which was music to our ears. And if that's the case, then, of course, we go back to compulsory representation and to 1937 and Jones and Laughlin. But even then, you went on to cite government as a market participant and talked about lowering the standard to mid-level, which struck me as you went on, to be almost rational basis, because it brings us to the question of what is the interest of the government in not just restricting speech, because here we're talking about compelled speech, which is different from the taxpayer example that you raised. Taxpayers don't agree with a lot of what government does with their money. Here you've got specific people being asked to pay for specific things. It's compulsory, compulsory speech. And so what is the interest in that compulsory speech when all the examples that you gave of variations in the states still result in the government as a market participant carrying out its function? I mean, what, when you look at these variations and they're all working, why is it that we need this extra measure?
So, you know, I guess I'd frame it differently. Maybe not surprising. In terms of, the way I look at it, you've got interest on the government side, you got interest on the employee side. Talk a minute about the interest on the employee side, which I didn't do as much as I might have earlier. The employee has an interest here. I acknowledge that. But, you know, the employee does, of course, the employee's speech is not being restricted in the sense that the employee is free as a citizen to argue that the union's taking the wrong position, to urge the legislature to reject the union's position, to urge the legislature to abolish collective bargaining, to engage as a citizen in any way he wants. So it's, you know, as, in that sense, I think you've got to, you know, take an accurate measure of the employee's First Amendment interest as employee. And, you know, it's there, it's real, but I also think it's important to keep it in perspective. And then on the other side of it, I guess what I would say is that, you know, if you start from the premise, and some of the questions kind of implied this, and, you know, fair enough, it's your point of view. If you start from the premise that this whole system is not legitimate, that it's just a way to funnel money into the coffers of particular political officials and parties, then, you know, I think it's hard for you to see the strength of the government's interest in this situation. And I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that the strength of the government's interest in this situation really is just as strong as the government's interest that the courts, and I bet most people in this room, perceive with respect to the other kinds of First Amendment claims that public employees make. And that, now maybe, you know, I may be misjudging you. Maybe you think that a sheriff or some other public employee ought to have robust, full First Amendment rights to challenge the outcomes of grievance procedures or restrictions, you know, on what that employee can say in the course of the employee's duties, or restrictions on that employee's ability to internally challenge certain government procedures. You might, it's a legitimate point of view. People could have it. People have taken those issues to the Supreme Court and argued them, but they've always lost. And they've always lost because the Supreme Court has recognized that when you're talking about the employment relationship and government as employer, the government's rights are stronger. The employee's rights are, in the context of being an employee, are diminished. And that all I'm trying to suggest to you in this conversation is that there is a way, and I believe it to be accurate, in fact, to understand that as a good faith effort on the part of government to carry out its core responsibility of delivering public services in the most effective way possible. Now, not everybody has to agree with that, but I think that that's a perfectly legitimate way to think about it.
Does the scale and the difference between those, the sheriff and the non-members paying, does the scale matter at all in terms of one individual employee grievance versus hundreds of billions of dollars for decades and decades spent against their will on political causes and yeah, policies they don't support?
So you can play the scale game in both directions. You know, it seems to me that government's got a much more powerful interest in avoiding a transit strike than it does in dealing with the complaints by a token booth operator that he wasn't allowed to put a poster up that he wanted in the token booth, you know, so it seems to me, I don't know, and again, just another way of saying, I think the idea of scale is manipulable in that you can think about, you can scale it in both directions and come up with hypotheticals where you contrast something small to something big in either direction. So I don't actually think it gets you.
I think it's not just the scale, though the court did rely on that in Harris as one of the reasons for rejecting the argument. But it's also that it's entirely different for the government to say to one of its employees, for example, you can't make a public statement criticizing this administration if you want to keep your job. It's another thing to say to that same employee, you've got to subsidize somebody else's speech.
I don't know, which is worse, right? I mean, which is worse? You can't say what you believe about politics and who should be elected president, but versus, yes, you have to pay this agency fee as part of being an employee here, but you can go out and criticize the union all you want. I don't know. You mean it's not self-evident to me that one of those is worse than the other.
But not with the $1,000 they took from you that year. So,
well, again, not self-evident to me that one of those is worse than the other.
In the back.
Akash Choglu, Americans for Prosperity. I was just going to ask if you can clarify this free rider question. So I've seen, and I'm not an attorney by background, but I've seen, like, James Shirk, when he was at the Heritage Foundation, wrote about a case retail clerks versus dry line goods that the Supreme Court stated that members-only unions are permissible, but then by law, you know, in these instances, they are required to represent non-members. So can you just clarify how that works? And then I guess my question in regard to the agency fee argument in terms of this, the free rider problem, is if Congress were to pass, and this proposal has come up in states, but if they were to pass a law like this sort of workers' choice concept that codify that unions are free to represent paying members only, would that change your calculation on the agency fee as as the free rider problem as justification for the agency fee?
So, I am not a labor law expert. I'm not familiar with that particular case you asked about in the first part of your question, and so I don't want to hazard a particular view about it. I just don't know enough to know. But I guess with respect to the second question that you asked, I'd want to think it through more, but it does seem to me a law like that would certainly change the calculus with respect to the free rider problem.
As the members-only question is good, because there's a trade-off the unions make between becoming the exclusive bargaining representative, and then they have the duty of fair representation. And the analogy is made, I think it's a poor one, too. If you voted for the other congressman and the other one's in power, he still has a duty to represent you, the person who did not vote, and that's the analogy that's usually made. But you can have, in unions, and in Europe this is much more common, members-only unions, which, by the way, have much stronger unions, that only represent that in multiple unions within a single workplace, only representing paying people. So, and the unions have make and will make a pretty big deal out of the duty of fair representation. Like, if you're not going to make these people pay us, then don't make us represent them. And we could see changes in law. And Ray, I'm sure he knows way
well,
more.
Well, the duty of fair representation was imposed as a statutory matter by the Supreme Court in a case called Steele.
Due to race.
Why? To save the constitutionality of monopoly bargaining. Mm-hmm. And what was happening in that case?
Race.
The union was discriminating against blacks.
Yeah. Ivan?
All right, thanks, Trevor. Ivan Osorio with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I want to go back briefly to a point that was brought up in discussion of Abood, which is the separation of political versus bargaining expenditures. There's a challenge that comes up that I see in this, and it's the fungibility of money. So I have a two-part question regarding that. Like, how would you draw that line, and can this issue of fungibility, whereas, money raised for one purpose can be used for another, can that be properly addressed?
Well, the problem is, as the Supreme Court recognized in Harris, that it's impossible to clearly draw that line. You start with the fact that who makes the classification in the first place? Who keeps the records? The union. And what do they want to do? They want to maximize the chargeable expenditures. Do you trust them? I don't. We found falsification of records in cases that we've litigated. And then as the court pointed out in Harris, that audit is only to see that money is spent the way the union said it was spent, but not to see whether their classification of categories comports with constitutional requirements. The auditors say, we can't do that, that's a legal question. So who's doing that? The unions. That's why they say, for example, political activity at conventions that Trevor alluded to is what? Chargeable. And then the courts have to try to figure it out if somebody can afford to hire an attorney or is lucky enough to have the Right to Work Foundation represent them to go to court. Because if you go to arbitration under the union schemes, the arbitrators are selected by whom? They're from a panel of arbitrators who have to be approved by the unions. The non-member never gets a say in who the arbitrator is. The whole system is rigged against the non-member.
Right. Don, do you have an opinion? Do you think the question of opt-in versus opt-out is closer than you're about overruling Abood?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that enough.
Okay. So you have to opt out of them taking your money and not opt in, which is a strange constitutional anomaly, even if they're allowed to say, you have to affirmatively say, don't violate my First Amendment rights. I see any other questions here? Yes, here.
David Sobels in Washington, D.C. I want to follow up on the question earlier about the free rider issue, and I want to ask those on the panel who would like to see Abood overruled if you would support a change in federal law to eliminate the requirement that unions represent everyone in grievances and collective bargaining and permit unions to represent only those who pay union dues.
We don't need to change the law. The Supreme Court has already said you can have member-only unions.
Do those come with members-only jackets?
But the unions don't want that. They want to represent everybody.
And the money they get from it.
For the money they get and for the fact that they have power to control what happens. If a non-member has a grievance, they are bound by the union's contract. They cannot ask for remedies from the employer that they want. They are stuck with whatever the union has negotiated.
I personally, it's important to point out and tell your reporters this as this case has been moving up, that I don't have any principled objection to voluntary unionization. And most people in this building would not. It's all the non-voluntary things that not only make it suspect and violating of rights, but also make them really unpopular. I think that the unions need to realize that if they went to a member-only model, and they can do that by not choosing the exclusive bargaining representation privilege that is granted them, if they went to that model, they might get more popular. Because it's the person who looks at his check who says, okay, every time I have $50 taken out of my check, and what do they ever do for me, that gets mad at the union. And unions have had an image problem for quite a while, and the only place it's going up is in the public sector. So if you look to Europe, and I don't want to give them tips about how to do it better, if you look to Europe and say members-only unions, they have a lot of other privileges there too, thrive. But they don't have the privileges granted to them. I see any other question? We're just about out of time. So Aaron, you're the last one.
Hi, Aaron Barnes, Cato Institute. Mr. Varelli, I was just, thank you for coming, first of all. I was hoping you could clarify and expound a little bit about your originalism argument. I found it a little bit confounding. What would you say as far as during the framing would be the most analogous situation to public sector unions taking fees from their members? I mean, I'm not a historian, but I don't really know of too many situations that were like that. The other end of the panel brought up kind of their fear of faction. Is there something that's closer than the fear of faction that you would say you could base an originalism argument? And then also, I was hoping you could maybe clarify your reference to Oliver Wendell Holmes. Is it your contention he was an originalist, or that we should decide the question based on the original public meaning in the 1890s, or did I just completely misunderstand your point?
So it's a very simple point. I think you actually do understand it, which is that when one became a public employee, the general notion was that one checked one's First Amendment rights at the door, that you didn't have any. That was Justice Scalia's point in dissent in Rutan with respect to patronage practices. It was what the opinion for the court said in Garcetti had been the understanding, you know, until really the mid-20th century. It was the point of Oliver Wendell Holmes' famous aphorism, that was the point. And that what happened in the middle of the 20th century, and look, it's a development that I think was a positive development, but what happened was that for the first time in the middle of the 20th century, you know, coming out of the anti-communism scare, really, and the loyalty oaths and whatnot that public employees were required to adopt if they wanted to keep their jobs, for the first time in the history of the country, it was recognized that public employees could assert a First Amendment right against a condition of employment. That until then, it had been the uniform understanding that you checked your First Amendment rights at the door. That's the point.
And I think that was spelled out in the unexpected brief by Eugene Volokh and Will Bode.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the framers would have agreed with FDR that public sector unions themselves are a very bad idea, but that's all the time we have today. I should leave it at that there. Join me in thanking our panel.